I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Ronnie Burkett joins me now. The acclaimed theater artist and puppeteer is about to open his latest show, Wonderful Joe, at the Cult. In the show, Joe and his dog, Mister, lose their home, and there's the possibility of the two of them being separated. I'll ask Mr. Burkett about the adventures that soon happen for Joe and Mister as they encounter Mother Nature, Santa Claus, Jesus, and the Tooth Fairy. It's a show about community and empathy and full of the warmth, imagination, and hope that Burkett is known for, alongside a new score by John Alcorn. Ronnie Burkett is a lifelong puppeteer who received the 2009 Siminovich Prize in theater, the Herbert Whitaker Drama Bench Award for outstanding contribution to Canadian theater, 4 citations of excellence from the American Center of the Union Internationale de la Marionnette. In 2019, he was appointed an officer of the Order of Canada and last year received the Governor General's Performing Arts Award for Lifetime Artistic Achievement. Wonderful Joe begins its run at the Historic Theatre at the Cults tomorrow night and runs until February 23rd. Visit thecults.com for tickets and information. We taped this interview a couple of weeks ago with Ronnie joining me from Toronto. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Ronnie Burkett. Mr. Burkett, good morning.
Good morning, Joseph.
Thanks for joining us. So Wonderful Joe isn't about me, right?
Well, maybe. You haven't seen it yet. We'll find out.
That's right, yeah. How do you... I'm always curious to know about your shows and how they come together. Is it really an idea that you have and then... For this show, for example, is this an idea that you have and then come up with the design of the show and how it looks, or how does it work in your process, say?
It's pretty much that, yes. It's I call it doodle writing, Joe. For a year when I'm on tour with, say, another show, and I get an idea, an abstract idea of a character or a central theme, and then I just noodle on it and write on it. Most of that doesn't stick, really. But, you know, this show was the idea of an old man and his dog at the risk of being separated because they've been evicted from their home, and what would they do to stay together? That's where it really started. And then it turned really into a piece about, you know, how many people are being unhoused and gentrification and life in an urban setting. So, yeah, it kind of just grew from Joe and his dog, Mister, and they're being separated. And from there, the story became more evident.
And this will hit home for a lot of people, especially here in Vancouver, because, you know, this is a time of great change, a time of uncertainty. I guess you're not just pulling puppet strings, but heartstrings as well with this, aren't you?
Yeah, and I was very clear with myself from the get-go that I wasn't going to do an overly sentimentalized piece about people in this situation. It's precarious in every city center I go to, and that's what I do. I tour and I go to cities. My own neighborhood, my own city is going through this. Housing scarcity and cost is a national crisis, for sure. But I didn't want to do one of those pieces about, oh, the poor, sad, unhoused people. I wanted to show the resilience of people and the humor of them and the survival. Because it is true, most of us are one paycheck away from being in a similar position. And so I think that's what really resonates with audiences, is that it's not this foreign group of people that we don't know. And if you live in a city, you are so hyper aware of this situation all the time now.
I was reading up about the show, and the character of Joe seems to find beauty everywhere, and that's an important characteristic, not just in him, but I think in how to approach life. I guess there's something we can learn about him, isn't there?
Yeah, Joe, you know, we do see Joe's backstory throughout the play. We see him as a child, we see him as a teen, and we see some serious hardships that Joe has undergone. But Joe resorts to, in a way, and believes in make-believe. So he fills in the cracks of his heart, if you will, with gold. He fills it in with make-believe or a view of the world that is healing and that is magical. And that's what makes him, I mean, he's an ordinary guy.
Mm-hmm.
He's an ordinary old man. And when I say ordinary, maybe for the other people in the audience, he's not. He's an old queer man. But that's not really hit over the head. You know, he's an old queer man. And I thought, I'm not going to justify that to a young queer audience or to a straight audience. They exist. Old queer people exist. You know, he just happens to be that. And so we see Joe's final adventure, which is, you know, I think when I started writing it, Joe, it was going to be that Joe and his dog would go on this fantastical adventure throughout the world and to make-believe places. And that went away very quickly. And so Joe's final grand adventure is a walk around his neighborhood in one day. So the play takes place the morning of him being evicted from his apartment to the end of the day where he's on a park bench at night.
And I can just imagine just how remarkable a day that is for him and for the audience.
Yeah, because he meets his neighbors. He meets the characters who live in the alley, who live on the street. And he meets some fantastic characters that some would say don't exist. You know, he goes into a bar and encounters Jesus, Santa Claus, and the Tooth Fairy. And they exist because he believes in them, you know, which I love. Because if you think about it, I'm asking an audience to believe that Joe is real. And so the audience has already suspended their disbelief to make that happen. So is Joe really that off the mark of believing in characters that don't exist himself, right?
Yeah.
Magic is real if you invest in it and believe in it. And if it is your reaction to tragedy or hardship, that you will still find something beautiful in your eyesight. I think that's so important.
Have you always been someone like that who's seen, you know, the good as well as the bad in every moment?
I think so. I think without puppetry, I might be quite hardened and cynical. But puppetry is my make-believe place, and I invent characters, and I get to be them and perform them. So I guess I'm not that dissimilar to Joe in a way that, you know, I invented Joe, and I love him, and he's not me. But I get to give him a life in front of an audience. So, yeah, I think I do try and fill the cracks with a bit of gold here and there.
I read somewhere that feeling that you have when you're on stage, because we can see you as we're watching your production, and you know, we see you above the marionettes and puppets, say.
Mm-hmm.
And you describe this feeling about the audience, say, looking at you and then looking below you and focusing on them, and what that feels like. I'm curious to know, Ronnie, when the audience invests in the story or invests in what's happening below you, I mean, you can feel that, can't you?
I do. I can actually feel the moment when, en masse, most of them shift down there.
Mm.
And that's lovely, and that's what keeps me focused on making sure the manipulation and the voice and the acting are all, you know, authentic in the moment, so I don't break the spell. Sometimes a thing will happen, a string will get caught or something, and the spell is momentarily broken, but I think by that point the audience choose when they look up at me or when they look down at Joe, and it all becomes one thing. And in a weird way, I've never thought this before. I'm making this up right now. It is suddenly they're all aware. They're looking in a crystal ball.
Mm.
So you're seeing the magic in the crystal ball, but you're also aware I'm looking at a crystal ball. It's just a thing I'm looking at, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that happens in theater. You know, that's why I keep doing theater. All of this talk about AI and all of that stuff, which is going to affect entertainment and the entertainment industry in ways we can't even imagine, won't touch the theater in the same way. Because there's something about a person on stage telling a story in an acoustic voice that is so still tribal ancient and magical that can't be replicated.
Yeah, there was a time there in recent years where we weren't able to go to the theater. And I think that's what people missed a lot was the community of it. You know, very different people in one room at the same time experiencing something, sometimes for the first time. And that feeling of whether, you know, you're feeling sentimental at that moment or laughing out loud or you know. I guess that's the wonderful thing about the theater, isn't there? This community that's created.
Well, and also in these very, very fractious times, you know, where people are taking extreme stances, there seems to be no middle ground often, certainly politically or socially. The audience is not even aware in a theater, and this is what is always fascinating to me, and I mean always, nightly, that this group of disparate people come in not knowing each other and somehow agree to be this community of witnesses. I never have understood how that happens, but it truly is remarkable when it happens, that we agree. We are a community observing something, listening to something. Everyone's going to have their own reaction.
Absolutely.
Everyone's going to have their own opinion. Absolutely. But during the telling of the story, there is this non-spoken agreement to invest in what's being told. And it's magical.
You're one of the few people who... is truly an artist as well as an artisan, and yet, you know, you're both at the same time. There's no end for you, or no beginning, or no, you know, where one stops and one begins. It must be, you know, I'm curious to know, Ronnie, for you over the years, because you've done this for a while now.
50 years.
yeah. What is it like to hone your craft, as it will, and do this all the time? Because I mean, you just seem to be somebody, and I've seen you interviewed for over the years, with this energy that's continuously creating shows like Wonderful Joe, as well as, you know, creating all the puppets and the marionettes and all that technical stuff at the same time. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you find that there are times where you have to take a break, or are you always going? Like, are you thinking of the next show as you're touring this one, say?
I'm already thinking of the next three shows. Mm. But, you know, I do get a wonderful break from myself, if you will. You know, right now I'm in touring mode, and Joe will tour all next season as well. So I know what my life will be like. It will be that guy in hotel rooms in other cities going to work at night. And there will come a time when I will be jonesing to not be that guy and to be the guy who gets up and goes into his studio every morning at 6 for a full year to build stuff. Mm-hmm. And by the end of the year building that show, I will be so bored of being that hermit that I can't wait to get out and perform. So it's built in that I get to give myself breaks from being one version of me, but it's all in service of the same thing, you know. Because, you know, in the studio, my goal and the refining of technique over the years has been pretty much singular. And what I wish for, what I try and teach young puppeteers, is you want to create the thing, the puppet. You want it to be the machine that does everything you expect it to do, that it represents that character and posture and movement. And you want it to have a reason for being on stage that's valid. You want the character to exist in that machine as well. And then the magical third part of the equation is, you never know, but you hope that the audience embraces that character you created as a machine and as a written thing. It doesn't always happen, Joe, but it happened with Wonderful Joe, and he is that triple header of machine and character and audience engagement. And so that makes it addictive. You know, you're like, okay, I got another idea. I wonder if I can do that again.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I can't. I mean, just thinking of your process as you were describing it, you know, how it works for you year to year, I can't help but think, you know, what that gives one as a creative charge, say, and want to continue to do it year after year,
yeah,
as you have.
And, you know, I just realized 7-8 years ago, you know, certainly with all the new language around us that's long overdue in the theater about art and, you know, all of that stuff, that we didn't even have these words, and I didn't really think it through. But as a child, when I first fell in love with puppetry, I realized that I've basically been on stage or as an artist, non-binary, my whole life, because I got to play Rapunzel and the Witch and Red Riding Hood and the Three Pigs and the Leading Man. And so I was cursed in a way by having the ability to morph because of puppetry. So much so that by the time I actually went to theater school, I found it unsatisfying because the only guise I had was my body, my voice, my gender, my age, and that was so limiting to me, having already been a puppeteer. So, you know, as I continue, and obviously getting older, it doesn't mean I still can't play Joe as a 10-year-old boy, which is
yeah, but you've obviously had a good ear over the years, because you do all the voices and have done all the voices as you have. Even as a kid, were you a good mimic, say?
Yeah, I was a little parrot. I would get myself into trouble constantly, you know, by mimicking neighbors or my dad's coworkers.
Yeah.
And, it was very funny until I crossed the line, and I always crossed the line, but yes. I was a mimic, you know, and I grew up on animation and all and cartoons and all of that stuff. And it's always just been amazing to me, the cadence of the human voice. You know, most puppeteers don't work in a text-heavy bass.
Uh-huh.
I love language. I love writing, and I love people speaking. So that's always been a natural for me.
The materials you use for the marionettes, for the puppets, have they always stayed the same over the years? I mean, you know, you're always seeing new materials, new compounds and things to use. Do you go with the times in terms of things like that?
I did when I was younger, because I think that's what you do when you're younger. You know, it's like, oh my God, there's this thing that the Henson shop is using. I had to try it. I've gone the opposite direction. I've gone very old school. And I try and make it as non-toxic to the studio as possible.
Mm.
So these puppets are basically papier-mâché pulp that I make and carved wood and cloth. So there's very little modern materials. Not to say they don't exist. If we're making molds, of course we use silicone just because it's much faster and more durable. But the actual puppets are, you know, papier-mâché pulp and wood and very old school, but it's also very durable, and it's a pleasant material to work in.
Yeah, and they have to, I mean, I've seen photographs online of your work over the years, and you know, up close, they're tremendous to look at, but I mean, they do have to project to a larger room, and those are considerations you obviously have to make, right?
Yeah, I've had a few studio assistants over the last decade, and I had two helping me build Wonderful Joe, two young guys, which was great. But they would also be encouraged to, if they wanted, use the studio after hours for their own work or stay late and, you know, just try their hand at sculpting. But I found that I was always, when they were drawing something or sculpting something, I constantly had to remind them to put it on the work table and go stand at the other end of the room and look at it from a distance. You know, what's it doing under light? Move your work light, or I'll hold it up and move it under light. You've got to look from afar, you know. So, and that's true. Even though my stuff is small and quite detailed, it does have to hit the back row, too, even if you're not seeing all the detail. And that's why I love marionettes, because you get the full body. And even if you're not seeing the facial detail as much as, say, a photograph in the front row, you are seeing the body posture, and you know that's an old man walking on stage, right?
And so these things, these marionettes, these puppets, they're an extension of you, caring for them as you travel and backstage as you are. I mean, you know, those are considerations that have to be made, right?
Oh, yeah. I'm obsessed with how they get packed, and my stage manager and I are the only ones who pack them ever. Mm-hmm. And we put, you know, like disposable diapers on their heads and their hands before they go into their bags, before they go into their trunks. And that is not so much that I'm precious with them. It's because I hate doing repairs on the road.
Yeah.
So I really am a bully in the studio that everything gets built as well as it can be, because I really don't, you know, on my day off, say in Vancouver, I don't want to go in the theater and repair puppets in the dressing room for 8 hours. That's just no fun. So, yeah, so we built them.
Yeah. So you're no stranger to working out here in Vancouver with the Kulch, especially, are you? And
oh, I have a long association with the Kulch. I think it's been over 20 years now, and I will say this, honestly, one of my top favorite audiences on the planet, which was a slow build initially.
Oh.
You know, a lot of people said to me before I was playing Vancouver, a lot of people said, you know, Vancouver's an odd theater town. They don't welcome foreigners.
Yeah.
Across the mountains. I have been embraced in Vancouver in ways that are... Well, I'm excited to come back, and especially to the Kulch, because so many of the audience have come back. And also what's been happening, which is really a great thing, is there's a whole new audience that shows up every time.
Mm.
We find that half of every audience now are first-timers, which bodes well, you know, for someone who wants to keep working.
Yeah.
The audience is regenerating itself. And I think, like you said about the pandemic, when we weren't allowed to go to the theater, and we live on our phones, and it's, you know, an increasingly false world in our hands. To go and congregate in a theater and hear a story and have a social event is in itself magical in ways that maybe it wasn't before.
Yeah. And you know, you described earlier, you know, that moment where the audience invests in the story, and you can feel that on stage.
I can ask you a question.
Sure.
I mean, you are a person who goes to a lot of live performance, right? And have for a long time. What's the hook for you? What draws you out to go see live performance?
You know, I think it's the idea of seeing something new, you know, because, you know, they make movies sometimes of plays or musicals much later. So the chance to see it new,
yeah,
in the theater, even if it's coming to Vancouver, you know, it's played elsewhere. That's something interesting. And I can't tell you, I mean, I've seen movies of things, and they're not as good as that moment that, you know, I remember which theater it was, or I remember where I was sitting, you know, which side of the theater, and those things, you know. And I, you know, you can ask me about a movie, and I'll say, yeah, I saw that movie, but I can't remember what it's about. But if you ask me about a play or a musical that I saw, yeah, I can remember the actors in it, or, you know, I can remember a song that I liked in that show.
Well, and the difference, too, is a movie will exist without us. The movies don't need us.
Yeah.
They exist, right? For whenever we want to see them. Whereas the theater needs the audience to make it happen.
Yeah.
There is no fourth wall. And half of the equation in that room is the audience being there. So I think, unbeknownst to many audiences, they know their importance. You know, I have this story that I was always kind of terrified of the audience, or when I was much younger, as a younger performer will do, I needed the audience to always be the same. I needed their reactions to be consistent. And if they weren't, I would get annoyed.
Yeah.
And it was at the Kulch maybe 8 years ago, and it was Saturday night. and the audience was on fire. They were so loud before the show. And I peeked through the curtains, and a lot of people were dressed. I could tell it was date night for a lot of people. They'd probably gone for dinner. You know, they paid for parking or an Uber or a babysitter and dinner at the Keg and tickets for a puppet show, and they were in. They were committed financially. Yeah. And I remember looking at them, and my entire view of the audience changed in that moment, and I thought, Ronnie, these people do not want this to fail. They have put their shoes and coats on and gone out. They want this to succeed more than you do.
Mm.
So for the next 2 hours, these are your best friends on the planet. And I go on stage every night now, Joe, with that in mind. Nobody's out there hoping this fails.
Yeah.
They want it to work.
Yeah, I think, you know, we as an audience, we play a part too, don't we? And I think we overlook that sometimes. And, you know, we certainly forget it when we have bad manners, like leaving our phones on or carrying our coats in and you know, our shopping bags and this sort. But, you know, there is a part that we all play in this. And, you know, that's why it's called show business, I guess, right? Because there's a show and then there's a business part.
Yeah, and it changed how I go to work every night after that moment backstage. I'm actually excited to go see who shows up because I do not expect every audience to be the same. I don't anymore. So I can't wait to see who shows up and what they smell like and how they're going to react. So I'm glad that happened. Otherwise, I think I've seen people get road weary. I see people get cynical. I see people kind of lose their momentum. And mine has certainly done the opposite. You know, I'm more enthusiastic about doing this than I've ever been.
But long may it continue. By the way, before I let you go, how do you take care of yourself when you're on the road? I mean, you have to look after your hands, obviously, your voice. Physically, I mean, are there certain things that you can't do because of the work that you do, say?
Well, I've learned over the years to not do anything during the day. I'm not that guy who will meet friends for lunch because I don't eat at that time of day. I don't talk till about 4 in the afternoon when I start warming up. I'm on the road to do the show. And, you know, I was just in New York for 10 days. We had a small run at Lincoln Center, and I have many friends in New York. And if they didn't want to hang out after the show, I couldn't see them during the day. So I'm pretty much a hermit. That's what I have to commit to, is just making sure I'm show ready every night, be it a Tuesday or a Sunday matinee or whatever. You just got to be ready to go. Because, of course, there's, you know, I caught a cold. So, you know, you steam, you gargle. But I do that every day anyway. So, yeah, you try and take care of the equipment as best you can.
Ronnie, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you today. I can't wait for the shows. I'm sure a lot of people in Vancouver can't as well to see you again. Break a leg, as I say. I so appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Joe. I'll see you in Vancouver.
The website for more is at thekulch.com. That's where you can get tickets and information for Wonderful Joe, which opens tomorrow night, Friday, the 4th of February, and runs until the 23rd. Ronnie Burkett, the show's star, creator, performer, joined me on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.